Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's January 27th, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. Chris, there are probably about 27 reasons that I'm better than you.
Yeah.
And this week, we got the 28th. And that was because Daniel Negreanu emailed me personally, to my personal email.
Wow.
Now, I don't know whether it was because he heard the show last week about the famous poker players, or whether he's just, you know, whimsical from our last meeting, you know, back, you know, when we played that charity tournament together. You remember that?
Yeah, I recall that.
You recall that you not being able to play with him and not playing with any celebrity?
I recall getting a autographed picture of him while you got to actually check raise him.
So I don't really know the reason for him sending the email, though the subject line did say Christmas fun. Which, you know, it came in January, so I initially was taken aback. I'm like, you know, maybe he's, you know, his calendar's a little off or something. But then I'm like, you know what, maybe he's just the type of guy that says Christmas is the holiday that keeps on giving the whole year round. And I'm just not going to worry about it because it's Christmas fun with an exclamation point. So I eagerly opened it to see what my good friend Danny Boy had to send me. And he started off with mate, M and the numeral 8. I find this incredibly efficient on his part, because imagine the time he saved typing M8 instead of M-A-T-E. That's two characters. That adds up over your lifetime, man.
That's right. If you just take that all the way out to its final conclusion, I mean, you're saving years on your life.
Oh, of course.
You know, like those stats that people put out, like people spend 8 years in a toilet during a lifetime. And,
yeah.
You know, people spend, you know, 3 years typing mates when they can type M8. During a
right,
lifetime.
Exactly. See? He is efficient. One more reason that he should be one of the top famous poker players, right?
Yep.
All right, so I'm going to read the email to you. I mean, I it was obviously meant personally for me, but, you know, I feel like the Ante Up Nation is extended family.
Yeah.
And should enjoy, you know, what Dan had to write to me, right?
Right.
And here's what it says. I came across this as a replacement for So Bad Cirrus Network. Little spelling challenge on Sirius. But, you know, he's quick. You know, he's saving
letters.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. It says, they've been around for almost 10 years and has been home for many guy across the world. Okay, now he's taking this a little bit too far now, Chris. He's leaving out whole words now, I think. And it has a link, which I'm sure if I clicked on would be perfectly legit, would do no harm to my computer whatsoever, right?
Right.
Then he goes on to say, there are idiots and easy there you will enjoy. So, you know, not only is he one of the best poker players in the world, one of the great ambassadors of the game, but he writes fortune cookies, too. He goes on to say, if you enter today, you get and more for your $$$$ at no charge, $750.
What the hell does that mean?
I'm getting more money. I'm not going to charge anything. It was better than that.
What the hell is $750?
But, you know, then I'm worried, you know, he's trying to send me to this new website and stuff, right? And I'm a little concerned, as I should be, right?
Because, yeah.
Well, you don't know what's out there, right?
Right.
But he goes on to assure me, Chris. He says, it's all secure and discreet, so you can be rest assured you are in good, very good, quote-unquote, hands.
Quote.
All right, so here's the thing. Whenever I hear discreet and hands in quotes in the same sentence, it's usually not a good thing.
I don't think that's a good thing.
All right. But all right, so I'm going to... But he's still trying to sell me on this, right? So he goes on and says, have a good run, man. Well, that's nice. Very positive. I like that. And that was the end of the email, but at the bottom it says, if you'd like to stop receiving messages from us permanently, you can do so here with a single click. And again, probably no danger at all in clicking that, but why would I want to stop receiving messages from Daniel Grano when they're so helpful, like this message I received?
I'm so envious.
Well, you should be. You should be.
You know, all I have is a autographed picture that I can pray to at night, and you have personal email contact with the great Real Kid Poker.
And not only that, but it's a great grammar spelling exercise for me, so it's good for the magazine, right?
I think we're going to put that in the letter section during our perspective area of the magazine. What do you think?
Oh, that's a good idea. That is a very good idea.
Man, that's just incredible.
Oh, yeah, of course, obviously, we're having fun. I hope everybody knows we're having fun here. I mean, this is an actual real email I got. Obviously not from Daniel. But really, do people fall for this stuff? And the answer is, I know, obviously, yes, or they wouldn't be sending it, but...
Well, let me ask you this. What was the email, not asked for the actual address, but was it like Daniel Granu at something? Is that how you knew it was from him, or what?
No, the actual name, you know, in your email box. You know, when you send it, it says Chris Cosenza. When I got it, it said Daniel Negreanu.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No, obviously the email address was some kind of weird thing or a bubbler, you know. So, but obviously, either a scam or spam, either way, probably both.
What's really funny is they got Daniel Negreanu saying there's an alternative to Sirius, which, you know, he obviously had nothing to do with. And then, like, they're trying to get you to go to another site when the whole world knows he's still with PokerStars. So if you know who he is and you recognize it, and that's why you're hoping that people will open it, is because it's Dan Negreanu. Well, then you know that Dan Negreanu's a PokerStar, so why would he even be? It's just hilarious. It's just such a bad choice.
Now, see, here's the problem with your anybody see the flaw in your Chris's logic? You're assuming that people that would fall for this kind of marketing we'll be able to piece together that Daniel Grano works for PokerStars and this is that.
No, I know, but I'm just saying.
There's this flaw. Next thing you're going to say is that you can actually get information out of the program at the horse track. Just stop right now.
If you know who Daniel Grano is and it makes you excited to open the email, then you know that he's for PokerStars, though. That's the thing. So it's just a bad, bad campaign on their part.
I'm sure the people that click on it, and if they're not, then they click on the bottom where, you know, you can unsubscribe, which never unsubscribes you. Just, you know, get you more spam from 97 other people.
So you didn't click it through, though?
I did not click
it through. See, now there are people out there who are going to say, hey, how do we know this is a scam if you didn't do your investigative journalism like you're supposed to and click through?
That is a very, very good point.
I say go to a friend's house and open up that email and then click through.
All right, through. I'm going to be at your house later today, so we'll open it up there.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious.
Oh, man. But, you know, I give them style points for, I mean, here's the thing, is how long I've been in this business and I've misspelled Negreanu. It's an easy name to spell, right?
Yeah.
Pitch perfect on that.
Yeah. Everything
they
else.
They can spell Sirius. But they can spell Negreanu, so.
I love the, when they misuse and. You'll get and more for your dollar signs. That's classic.
But it is secure and discreet, so, you know, apparently I can not only play online poker there, but I can get lingerie, so.
Well, you know, on some more serious stuff, we had a poker room manager call us asking us about there's some new trends in re-entry tournaments allowing you to concede your stack before day 1B and then re-enter as a new player in day 1B. What do you think that's all about?
Well, the manager called me and I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, we've seen it. It's starting to happen in a couple tournaments. We don't know whether they're going to do it in our room. We're going to see whether it takes off or not. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, you enter day 1A, or I guess 1B if there's a day 1C, you know, whatever the next day
is. Right, right.
And at the end of the night, you don't have a lot of chips. And they'll give you until the gun goes off in day 1B to walk up to him and say, wave the white flag, I quit. And they take your chips out of play, and then you rebuy in, because it's a re-entry tournament, right? As a brand new player, and you start fresh with a decent stack on 1B and try again.
Now, the question I have for you, so it is, I think I misunderstood. So it is until the gun goes off on 1B for you to say it. So in other words, you could survive one day. Day 1A, I mean.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, okay. Because at first I thought it was like, you have to leave the tournament while it's in progress.
No, no, no. You can go home at night and do all your mathematical calculations and think about it, figure out your table draw the next day and who's playing, and decide, you know what? I got a better chance at winning this tournament if I just give up this deck, buy back in, and start fresh with 10, 20, 30,000 tomorrow, whatever, rather than trying to build up my 2 or 3 grand or whatever I have now.
At first blush, I don't like this policy. I think for the main reason that the chips are taken out of play, I would assume.
Yeah, and that was the first thing I asked. I'm like, now, what do they do with the chips? And he's like, yeah, they take them out of play. And I'm like, wow, that does not seem right.
No.
And because here, if I'm a player and I'm just playing it normally, I'm not doing this conceding thing, I would want those chips to stay in play. You know, they were paid for, they're there, somebody should be able to win them. So they should be blinded off the next day as if that person is still in the tournament but not playing. Now, obviously, the mechanics of all that would make that nearly impossible.
Yeah.
You know, how do you police making sure someone doesn't play that stack when that's not really, you know, I mean, I guess there's a way you could do it, but it certainly wouldn't be worth it. So that would be my problem from a player standpoint, that the chips come out of play. Now, I guess the flip side of it from a player standpoint is if you got these people that don't listen to the Andy of PokerCast, don't know how to play a short stack, and they're just going to keep quitting and buying back in, that's going to help the prize pool. It's going to get more people in and more money in. So maybe that balances out the fact that they're taking, you know, 2,000 chips here or there out of the tournament.
But don't – and again, I know that there's scenarios where you will survive, but don't you think that anybody can get rid of chips at some point in a tournament if they need to, like raise and then fold? You know what I mean? It's just like, how hard is it to lose your stack if you want to come back the next day?
Well,
I assume it's when the day's over is when they're –
Yeah, well, there are reasons, too. I mean, I thought about that, too. But obviously, I mean, what happens if you suffer really bad being the last hand of the night? You don't have a chance to to shove on the next hand. So, I think it's probably a smaller group of people that would take advantage of this because of that reason. I think you're right. You know, if it happens a half an hour left before the end of the night, those players are going to be shoving every hand until they either bust out or build up.
Yeah, because it'll embolden you, too. I mean, if you think about it, it really... You're like, hey, it doesn't matter if I lose, cause I know I'm buying in tomorrow, so why don't I just keep shoving and trying to double and triple and quadruple up or whatever, and then maybe I won't even have to buy in tomorrow. You know what I mean? So it just seems so odd to me. But I understand now. I was really under the impression that you had to surrender before the hand, you know, before the tournament day was over, your mind.
You can sleep on it, come back next morning, and say, hey, I'm out.
I don't think I support this rule.
You don't support it?
No.
I think it's I don't know if I've ever, I mean, I guess if you're gonna force me to decide, I just think it's weird. But again, I think this is the same thing that we talk about with, like, you know back in the days of the online poker with the random card generator, and for you it just seemed weird.
Yeah,
that was your big argument. It just doesn't seem right to me. It's the same. This is the same thing. It just doesn't seem right. But I guess it doesn't mean it's not. You know. I mean, if I'm in a tournament and I got 190,000, I'm bagging 190,000 at night on day one, you know, which happens all the time. I would love to have more people get in there and boost that prize pool up because I'm in a good spot to win this thing.
I mean, I like the if a tournament's a tournament. If those are the rules we're playing by, and you know them going in, then you could play or not play because you don't like it or you do like it. But
right, yep.
I just don't. I don't think it's a good idea to take chips out of play. I just don't. I mean, I don't know. It's just weird to just
remove chips.
Yeah, that's
the big weakness. If they could find a way not to take the chips out of play, then I think I'd be better with it. I mean, I guess the other side of it, too, is, you know, if you're the type of player that's going to quit because you have too few chips to play your game, that's to my advantage, that you can't quit.
Yeah.
Because those players just, they don't know how to play. When they get down to 2,000, it's they're giving up anyhow.
Yeah.
And I love those players. And why would I re-enter? This way, I mean, they're trapped, and they're half to force, and they're probably going to shove on the first hand the next day. They're probably going to be eliminated, and then they're out because they can't re-enter again.
I think there's a good reason to have it for players who had to travel, like, a long way to be there. And if they know they've already planned to be there 4 or 5 days and there's nothing else going on the next day or something, that's, you know, hey, they can – they've traveled all this way. Why come back the next day Or if they just, you know, have a long way to go home, why come back the next day to just play for 5 minutes when they could come back and try to start all over again and, or whatever. And I guess the other side of your point you just made, though, is that, like you said, somebody suffers a bad beat and at, you know, the stroke of midnight or whatever, then, you know, it's not that they're a poor player. They don't know how to play short stack. It's just that they got a bad beat and now they like a chance to play again, but they have 5 chips left and the tournament went off, you know? So, I just don't think I like it. I think that it's just weird taking chips out of play and giving people another angle shoot sort of way. I mean, it's not really an angle shoot. If it's a rule, it's a rule. But you know what I mean? It just seems like they can play any way they want. And if they don't lose all their chips, no big deal. I'll just show up tomorrow and get a whole new stack for free. Well, not for free, for the price of admission. So I don't know. I just don't like it.
I think it's one of those rare, interesting things where it's a player-friendly rule and a player-hostile rule at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're able to take advantage of it, this is a great rule. If you did well the day one and you don't want these players back in, then it's a hostile rule at the same time. That's a tough one for managers, I think. I think it's probably why not a lot of people are doing it right now. But, you know, a lot of people were doing re-entry tournaments when they started, too, and now all of a sudden they're everywhere.
So. It's kind of like hosting the Oscars. No matter what you do, someone's going to hate you and someone's going to love you. Either you're going to be too funny and not take it seriously enough, or... So, it's a no-win situation. So, but I just don't like the idea of taking chips out of play. So, that's just my stand. Hey, we have a hotline, 813-448-1120. Call the hotline. We use it. We'll give you something cool. This one comes from Todd in Georgia.
I just have a suggestion for your analyzing hands. Y'all seem to kind of go a little back and forth on hands and can't agree on anything. But anyway, it's a little crazy to kind of listen to on the podcast. If you don't mind, will you kind of develop a little systematic approach to the way y'all do hands, maybe? It was just whether you're betting a hand for value or bluff or semi-bluff, and you know, and what are the possible hands that could be calling you. Just some kind of systematic approach, because y'all kind of get all over the map and kind of get off topic sometimes. And anyway, it just seems sometimes it's a little hectic to listen to. And anyway, it'd be great if y'all could somehow get a systematic approach. Anyway, I'm still stuck in Georgia. No casino close.
Now, I listened to this, and the minute he started saying being systematic about it, I started to imagine, are you systematic about the way you play poker? Every situation is different in poker. Every hand is different. So every time we get the hand of the week, it's so difficult for us to be rigid or have a form that we follow or whatever. I just don't see that happening.
Well, yeah, I think that was my first reaction, is that in poker, nothing systematic in poker.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the mechanics of it are systematic, but the art of playing it is not systematic. So it doesn't strike me as something that we should try to do when dissecting a hand. But a point well taken that, you know, it's obviously difficult to hear somebody go off on tangents and stuff. You know, you should probably find a way not to do that. But, you know, not that I'm trying to defend everything here, but, you know, we have a good discussion going on the forum now about last week's hand of the week, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But, you know, the value in these is really having the time to discuss a hand in full detail. When you're at the table, you don't have that time to even think about it in full detail, let alone discuss it with other people. So I think this is one of the things, as frustrating it might be sometimes to hear a discussion go on several tangents, in the end, if you're able to distill a lot from it, then it's probably worth it, and you might end up losing something by muzzling.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that I think by putting parameters on the mechanics of it and then discussion of it, you're losing what could the real fruits that could be coming from that labor. I just feel like even a discussion that we come up with, sometimes, you know, in our minds it sounds right, but to everyone else it's foolish. And then they put it on the forum and discuss it even further. So a lot of times the hand will be put on the forum and then people will discuss it there with the directness of that I'm sure Todd is craving. But for us, it's more of a, hey, let's look at alternative ways to play this, and the only way to do that is to go on tangent. That's not just here's the optimal play. If you wanted the optimal play on everything, all we gotta do is come up with an algorithm and then just play the computer
mechanical voice. Don't encourage anyone to come up with that.
I'm just saying. I mean, you could be replaced by a program or an app or something. So really, it's all about the human element. So that's why we like to talk about hands and discuss our different approaches on things rather than just say, okay, this is the flop. What do you do? This is the turn. What do you do? These are the blind. You know what I mean? It's more of a feel thing, but.
I certainly am interested in getting more feedback from our listeners on this. I guess my other fear, too, is, you know, we try to be systematic with how we put the magazine together every month.
Right.
You know, we have, rules. We want this to here. We want this to be this size. When that, and every month, we have 12 more discussions. Hey, this doesn't fit nicely into that plan. What do we do with it? And I think that would be the situation at the hand of the week. I mean, even if we set up a systematic way of breaking it down, you're going to get a hand that deviates from that, and then what do you do?
Right. It's all dependent upon the person sending the hand in on what they provide. Sometimes they're asking questions that we have to answer, or they're looking for alternative ways to do something at a certain street, or it's a different game, and it doesn't even lend itself to the system that we've put in place because 95% of the hands are Nolan Hold'em, but sometimes we'll get a Badoogie hand or something. Who knows? But it's very difficult to be systematic about something that's not systematic.
I would love to get a Badoogie hand.
No, I wouldn't.
All right, Tom, we definitely appreciate the feedback, and we'll take it under advisement and see what other folks have to say about it. In the meantime, though, we're going to reward you for calling the hotline at 813-448-1120 by sending you a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Oh, we got a mailbag, too. We're hitting on all cylinders today. I'm going for the cycle, I think. It comes from Gene. He says he has an ethics question. Playing a tournament and getting down to the last two tables, the blinds are getting high and they pay 10 places with about 16 players remaining. Our table all notices the blind level has increased, but the dealer doesn't notice. The other table is playing the correct level, but our table stayed at the last level because neither the dealer nor attorney director noticed, and everyone is holding on trying to make the final 10. So the players say nothing. Is it the responsibility of the dealer and or attorney staff to make sure we're playing the correct blinds? We're hand for hand and the attorney director is watching both tables. Should one of the players, in all fairness, say something because it's the right thing to do? Did we do anything wrong by staying quiet and playing at the lower blinds?
Wow. Definitely an ethical situation here.
Purely ethical.
All right, well, I, in an attempt to try to answer this, I went to the Poker TDA rules, see what kind of advice they could give us. And as usual, they didn't have anything specific on this.
As usual. So
this is one of those rule number ones in the best interest of the tournament. But I think there's some wisdom that we can cull from some of the stuff I found here. Rule number 9, new hand and new limits.
19. Yeah.
What did I say?
Rule 9.
Rule 9?
Yeah.
This is better than 9. It's 19.
That's right. It's 10 more better.
It's 10 more better. All right. Rule 19, new hand and new limits. When time has elapsed in a round and a new level is announced by a member of the tournament staff, the new level applies to the next hand. A hand begins with a first riffle. If an automatic shuffler is being used, the hand begins when the green button is pushed. All right. So based off that, I would say the new level doesn't take effect until it's actually announced. Am I being splitting hairs there?
No. If it's literal, it's that. If the word and was replaced by or, we'd have a whole new ball of wax. Instead of when time has expired in a round
and,
or.
Yes, you're right. The and is the most important.
The and
word.
Is the worst part right there. So the tournament staff hasn't said anything to you. You keep playing and say, hey, those guys are playing a higher blind. They shouldn't be. They should be playing a lower blind because no one said anything.
I know most tournaments. I shouldn't say most tournaments. I've played in tournaments before where the tournament director has said, the level does not go up until I actually announce it, regardless of what the clock says.
Right.
Which I think is weird, because that's why you have a clock, right?
Right, but, you know, maybe he's doing the old FIFA injury time rule thing, and and he's like, well, I made a decision over there that took too much time for that table, and maybe I'm just letting the blinds go. I have no idea.
But at that point, I mean, you should be stopping the clock in the
judgment. I know. So, I'm just joking.
But, yeah, you're right. I mean, literally speaking here, I think Gene and his buddies at that table were in the clear. Now, Rule 51, no disclosure. Players are obligated to protect other players in the tournament at all times. Now, this is the classic, Rule 13 or Rule 16 that we talk about at Beau Rivage, right?
Yes.
Where every player and staff member has an obligation to speak up when they see something incorrect to protect players. And in this case, I would think that would mean you're obligated when you see that the time is expired and the other table's playing at the higher blind to say, hey, we should be playing at the higher blind.
That's right, because it's not that you're protecting the players at your table, you're protecting the players at the other table, because exactly. They're at a disadvantage.
They're at a disadvantage, yeah. All right, then rule 53, ethical play. Poker is an individual game. Soft play will result in penalties, which may include forfeiture of chips and or disqualification. Chip dumping and or all other forms of collusion will result in disqualification. Now, I think it's a stretch to say this is collusion going on at this table where everybody's keeping quiet. Would it can be considered soft play to not speak up about the blinds and purposely playing an incorrect blind level?
It's interesting too that he said in the email that everybody at the table knew the blinds. How did he know it? Was he inside everyone's mind? Or is he the only one that would have sit and watch?
Maybe a break they got together and like, hey man, should we have said something? Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I didn't say I don't know. You're right. But, you know, you can also look around and see the eyes and see people looking at the clock and looking back down at the cards in shame, you know. You might be able to figure that out.
Okay, so we got Joe Navarro at our table then, apparently. I think it's unethical. I think it's unethical. I'm not saying that I'm not guilty of it myself because I'm near the bubble and I'm thinking, oh my God, if I get one more hand in, I miss the blinds. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough. I don't really recall that happening lately or recently. Then again, I don't play a lot of tournament poker anymore either. It's definitely not ethical.
No.
When you take all three of these rules into consideration and that you're supposed to be playing on a level playing field at all times and you know they're at a level different than you, it's unethical. Something has to be done. Either they have to be brought back down to your level or they have to say, oh yeah, sorry, the blinds went up. I do recall saying the blinds go up a lot when I've played, saying it's a new level. You know.
I think this is kind of goes back to what we talked about last week with the guy arguing with our hero for pointing out that the pot should have been split.
Yeah.
Hey, you cost me half the. So you know, you're starting to argue about being dishonest, and I think that answers your question, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, even if you were to invoke the literal meaning of Rule 19 here and say, "Hey, whoa, tournament director, you didn't say anything." I still think that's not in the spirit of the game, right?
Right.
And therefore, I think it gets into unethicalness. Unethicalness? Is that a word? I'm going to try that in...
Unethicality.
So, yeah, I guess in the future, speak up.
Yeah, speak up and live with it.
Yeah. And remember, even if the blinds go up, I mean, it obviously depends on your chip stack there, but I mean, there's a possibility that you're going to get more money. I mean, what if you stay quiet because you're a small blind or a small stack at the table and you didn't want to have to put in the full amount for the big blind and you get pocket aces and you just cost yourself some money?
Yeah. Yep.
So,
I mean,
it cuts both ways. So you might as well just be upfront and honest and
take the high road.
Play it the way. Yeah, exactly. It's the road less traveled.
I wonder if Gene made the money.
I did not say.
Well, one thing I know he did make was the swag shelf. He's going to get a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net. Congrats, Gene!
Awesome, Gene. And, you know, following on that, I guess that could have been a call to the floor. I wonder if Jody will chime in on that later on. But we have our official call to the floor this week. And speaking of hitting for the cycle, our good friend David Bloomberg, I think has been on every segment of our show in the past couple months, has completed the cycle now with the call to the floor. And he wrote in, and it's a good one. He says, the bad beat at this location requires aces full of tens to be beaten, and both cards in your hand must be used. We had a hand where the flop came out, ace, king, queen, followed by an ace on the turn and another ace on the river. Pocket tens folded the flop, but two hands made it to the river, pocket jacks and king eight. The king eight, of course, had a full house, but was not eligible for the bad beat because his eight didn't play. The question, therefore, revolves around the jack-jack and the 10-10, and what would have happened if the 10-10 had made it to the river along with the king-8. All right, I'll pause so everybody can catch up here.
Right, so in other words, what's happening is a full house with three aces on board came, someone had pocket jacks, someone had pocket tens, and someone had king-8, and so the king-8 hand would have made the biggest full house, and the tens had folded. But if the tens hadn't folded, we're looking at three full houses, two of them are... bad beat jackpot eligible.
Right.
Okay.
All right. If the king eight had the other two covered and or they weren't all in, the bad beat would have not been hit because the winning hand would not have been eligible. But what if the king eight had been the shorter stack than the jack jack and 10-10? There would have been a side pot that would have been would have had both a winning and a losing hand that were eligible for the bad beat. Would that have been considered a winner, or does it only apply to the main pot? I recognize each room may have slightly different rules for its bad beat, but I figured there would be some continuity in general opinion.
That's really interesting. I can't believe it's taken four years for us to actually have someone ask that or have us think about that. Really. I mean, really, 4 years of doing the magazine and seven of doing the show.
Yeah.
And it's never come up. And I don't know the answer to this. I know Jody's going to give an answer here, but I really don't know the answer regardless of what Jody says. Because it's like one hand still lost, but the one that beat it wasn't qualifying. It's just really weird.
Yeah, and, you know, I was trying to figure this out myself because I always like to reply with what I think and always say, you know, hey, we're going to pass it on to Jody. He's the expert. Don't really give any credence to what I say. I'm just some crazy podcast host.
Right.
But for my own thing, I tried to think about what I would rule, and this one seemed a little tricky to me. And then when Jody writes in, as Jody always does, I was like, oh, man, makes a perfect sense. Should have figured that out.
Okay, so Jody says, each room should be doing this exactly the same. The question that would have to be answered in the question of the king eight being all in is, which pot did the bad beat dollar come from? That will tell you which pot is eligible to hit the bad beat. I would like to welcome comments on this from one of from other room managers to see how they would view the situation. So he's saying that the main pot, if it came from the main pot, then obviously it has to come from the main pot. It can't come from any other pot because the dollar is taken from the beginning.
It depends on the room. That's what he's saying. Some rooms won't take the bad beat dollar until a certain level. You know, so if it's only $10 in the pot, they don't take it. And also, you should be cognizant of this because the pot has to be a certain level for it to be bad beat eligible.
Right.
In fact, this was interesting. One of our good friends, Nick Sorrell, writes a great gambling blog down at Sun Sentinel, posted today he went to a brand new poker room and played a little bit, and he flopped quads. Never in my life! but it was like three aces on board, and he had ace-deuce in his hand. By the end of the hand, his deuce kicker didn't play, obviously, so it didn't qualify. But he was talking about it. People said, hey, if you would have gone all in and got people to fold, then your kicker would have played on the flop. And he's like, oh, yeah, shoot, I would have cost myself $500. Well, there wouldn't have been enough. I don't know what the specific rules are there, but I can't imagine that the $8 in the pot there would have been good enough to qualify for the bad beat. Does
right,
that
so,
make sense?
Yeah, so what you're telling me then is, let's say the king eight was all in for deuces with $2 or something, and then the other two guys called the $2, and that's a $6 pot.
Right.
And then the side pot is where the dollar would come from, and so the side pot could possibly have the bad beat dollar taken from it. So it's just those two players.
It depends on the room, but yeah. I mean, if you know, if the policy in the room is, and people, I think this is the thing that people have to realize about the rake too is, every room does it different, but most rooms don't take the first $5 out of the pot and put it in the rake. It's a percentage, you know,
right.
A dollar on each $10 or something. And same with the bad beat. The bad beat is taken out when it gets to qualify. If it hits $20, then they take the $2 out or the dollar out at that point.
Hmm.
In fact, actually, Elliot talked about this on the show when he was on, too. It all depends on when the jackpot dollar is taken out as well, too. And again, that's why when people say there has to be $20 in the pot, it's not just some arbitrary thing where the room is trying to deny you of a jackpot. It's that, you know, they haven't taken the dollar out of that jackpot yet, so that jackpot isn't eligible.
So how about this? How about it goes $6, the guy's all in the main pot, and then the side pot only makes it $4 because there's one bet and then one call, and they don't get it all in just because it's a big hand doesn't mean you have to.
Yeah.
And then now there's not enough money in each pot to combine. You know, it's just a weird thing.
It's not eligible at that point.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, my God. So you're telling me there's $10 total in the pot, but it's still to win, but it's still not eligible? Or
I don't know of any beats that are eligible at $10 at the bottom, and usually 20, I think. But again, it depends on the room. I mean, some are eligible right away. I mean, they do take that first dollar in the pot goes to the jackpot, and then the entire thing's eligible. So it just depends on the room you're in.
Yeah,
So I think that's the answer. But and I guess, you know, I would love for everyone to do this exactly the same as Jody says, but I think that would require that the taking a break and the taking of the jackpot is consistent from room to room.
Man.
Which is never going to happen.
That's really, really a good question.
Probably shouldn't happen, because that makes your decision easier between two rooms, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm a jackpot player, I'm going to want to go to the room where the dollar's taken right away, because I want to win that jackpot regardless of how much money's in the pot. If I'm a player that's basing my EV on not winning jackpots but on outplaying somebody, I'm going to want that rake and that jackpot rake taken at the last possible moment.
Huh. Wow. I can't believe it's taken us this long to have this situation come up. Really, it's just remarkable.
It's a good one. It's a good one. I mean, and this is what I think is important about this one, too. I mean, all the calls and floors are really important, but this one is one of those things where you're stuck in this hand, right?
Yeah.
And you've got this hand, and you're trying to make decisions based on what the ruling is without being able to ask what the ruling is. And it's not one of those things where you want to raise your hand like, hey, just curious. It has nothing to do with the fact that I've got cards and we're middle of a hand with a heavy board here. But what's the bad beat qualifier? How much money has to be in the pot? Which spot does it come from? Oh, okay, great, thanks. I raise. You can't do it, you know? So, and we're talking usually these bad beats or even high hands. I mean, you're talking significant money there.
Yeah.
You don't want to risk that. And so, I mean, of all the things you need to do when you go to a new poker room and sit down, it's tough to remember to go review the bad beat and the high hand rules, but usually they have a flyer out. I usually grab one, and, you know, you got a lot of downtime. You know, you fold your hand, and I try to read it over, make sure I completely understand, so I'm not stuck in this situation. Of course, this situation's a little different. But,
yeah, because you still don't know the answer to it.
Right.
Because that's not when you're broken
general,
down.
But in general, you should know at what the qualifications are for the bad beat in that room. If you're playing in that room for the first time, you know, is it, you know, aces full of 10 beaten, or is it quads beaten? Is, you know, how much money needs to be in pot? Do you need to use both cards or one card? Those are all important things to know, so when you're in the middle of a hand, that you don't have to, you know, look at the sheet or ask a question and give up your hand, because, you know, the worst thing you can do is make a decision trying to win a bad beat and find out that the decision you made wasn't going to get you the bad beat anyhow, and then you lost money in the actual pot.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. I don't know if any managers actually listen to our show, but if they do, you know, let us know what you think. I mean, I suppose we could actually do something with this in the magazine, too, if we wanted to.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think we should run in the magazine and see what people say. Absolutely. All right, David, we appreciate you sending the call to the floor. And remember, in 2012, the call to the floor is now bad beat eligible for a swag shelf. And we only have to use one of your questions out of your two that you send in. Crickets. It's funny to someone. Somebody's out there laughing. And we are going to send you a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Ante Up. You can pick up your own decks in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
What a week for feedback.
Yeah,
you know,
we
mentioned the hand of the week. And, you know, we started out as just, hey, it's just the hand of the week, and everyone should have folded pre-flop, but since you didn't, here's what we would have done. And all of a sudden, bingo, bango, bongo. Everybody's chiming in about it on anteupmagazine.com/forum from the show last week. Just people just giving their opinions on how badly you and I talked about it and how terrible we are and how math rules all. And if everybody followed math, we'd all be a happy society. And so, last week, you know, we don't want to talk about the hand all over again, but you should really check out the forum and hear what other people had to say about the hand from last week. And then even our famous poker players. Main topic last week, there were some players left off the list that people thought should have been on.
Yep.
Dina Miller wrote in, said she really enjoyed the show and was intrigued with the segment. And then when you were discussing the Family Feud style of answers that are the general public would know as a poker player, you were excluded to mention Jean-Robert Balland, or as his personal friends call him, Bobby. But doesn't like to be called that when you're
Chris,
running across Chris the Foxes
included
floor.
In the inner circle.
He was on a Survivor China season, and for 4 months the mass public watched this professional poker player play. The constant exposure of on one of the highest rated shows to the American public would surely warrant at least an honorable mention. Now, what I said to her, I said that was a good point that she brought up. One of the things I thought about Jean-Robert though was one. that he actually was one of the first ones voted out, so he didn't last 4 months. He lasted about a week and a half. And then two, I still don't think that something that happened that many years ago, we were still at the Times when that happened, we interviewed him on at the Times,
yeah,
that many years ago, he's going to walk down the street and the general public's going to know who he is by seeing him or by hearing his name. I still don't think people in the real poker world know who Jean-Robert Belland is. So although I give her credit for finding a very, very public way of a poker player being known.
Yeah.
Because now it's like saying Jim Rice now is, he could walk down the street because he's a poker player and he was on, of course, he's also a medical marijuana seller, so I'm sure he's known in the ganja group. But really, I mean, I just don't think people would recognize him like they would recognize a Doyle Brunson or, like we said, Amaral Slim or whatever, that name. So, but it was a good addition.
Yeah, I'm glad you wrote in because I did think about that before the show and forgot to add it, and for those reasons. And he actually did last longer than a week and a half on the actual airing of the show.
Right, but it wasn't 4 months.
But here's why I didn't put him on. I wasn't convinced that I could properly pronounce his name.
You just call him Bobby.
You know, when you're typing a letter and you're trying to use that word and you can't figure out how to spell it and you respell it and you spell it again and spell check keeps saying you're an idiot, then you just change the word.
I just change the word.
So I'm like, John Robert, blah, blah, blah. You know what? Let's just skip him off the list.
Could have called him JRB. Apparently he's known as JRB, too. I don't know.
All right. Well, also on our Facebook page, latecomer mentioned Greg Raymer.
Yeah,
and I immediately said, "Yep, you know what? That's another odd omission that didn't make our list or any of the other people that sent an in list, and probably should have been on there." But again, probably doesn't quite hit that man on the street knowledge level. I don't think they might if it was the Marley's Pub picture page that we talked about. Then I'm sure people would probably recognize the goofy glasses. But to actually mention the name or ask, you know, name a poker player, I don't think Greg Raymer's gonna fly off the tongue.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But again, he is very popular.
Oh, absolutely.
But I just don't think that Joe Schmo knows him.
And then last night we got an email from a frequent contributor, Mike Myers. We'll put the obligatory Halloween joke in here like we always do. he actually put some effort into this, Chris. He actually typed in a bunch of pros' names in Google search to see which one had the most hits. And he said Phil Ivey did. Out of the 10 or so pros he put in.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything, though. I mean, it could be a lot of things contributing to the whole Full Tilt thing, stories that are generating his name because of the Full Tilt thing or his divorce. So I don't know if that's... I mean, I don't know if that makes him popular in the general public, though. That could just make him popular in poker stories, you know?
Yeah, and I guess kind of the analogy I was going to use is, you know, hey, people are probably catching a rerun of Mobsters and seeing the whole Whitey Bulger story, and they're typing, hey, I want to learn more about Whitey Bulger, and typing in, oh, at the same time that everybody that knows who Whitey Bulger is typing in because he just got caught after two decades on the lam.
Yeah.
And they're all searching for it just to find out more about that. How do you know which one is which? So.
Yeah.
And I think he's probably right. I think the traffic on Phil Ivey had more to do with actual poker players trying to find out what's going on with him now than random people saying, hey, Phil Ivey? But nonetheless, an interesting exercise, even if it doesn't quite fit what we're talking about, but it's nice to know those figures.
And I'm glad people are still contributing. They're making our show that much more complete. Hey, speaking of helping make us things complete, if you want to be part of Team Annie Up, consider becoming one of our ambassadors. We're looking for folks in Arizona and Louisiana now, but we're always interested in receiving applications from anywhere in the U.S. You can apply at annieupmagazine.com/ambassadors.
Yep, you never know when we're going to have another opening pop up, so
yeah, you just never know.
Be the first one in.
And don't forget that we've added three new quick links on our website on the homepage, one for each of the archives of Joe Navarro's columns, Jonathan Little's strategy columns, and of course, Lee Child's. So you can see all their great Annie Up magazine work just at a click of a link. Great resource for strategy, I think.
Absolutely. And first time we're announcing this, we are doing 3 cruises next year, Chris. Or this year, I guess I should say.
This year, 2012.
See, that was the first time we're announcing next year.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember March 17th out of Tampa, August 27th out of Port Canaveral, and November 10th out of Baltimore. Go to anyupmagazine.com/cruise for more information and the phone number to call the book. And also, I guess I never announced, but we added a cruise page.
What
cruise guide.
Oh, cruise guide. Okay.
You know, if you've never been on a cruise before and you want to learn about what you do on a cruise, how you pack, how it works, or if you've been on a cruise and you've never been on a poker cruise and want to learn more about how it works, go to anyupmagazine.com/cruise, click on the cruise guide link, and lots of more information.
Lots. It's exhaustive. It took me 4 hours to read it all. That's how much stuff Scott wrote on there.
I just added more stuff this week. Somebody's real concerned about the alcohol policy. Very, very shocking for poker players to be concerned about the alcohol policy on board. But I added that in there.
Okay, let's see what was generated on the Antiup news desk this week.
In a poker news exclusive, William Holly, the man who bought Peter Eastgate's World Series Poker Championship bracelet for $147,000, $147,500, said he's interested in talking with World Series officials about donating the bracelet back and awarding a replica in a charity tournament.
Okay.
All right, so here's the thing. The guy, he made his money in, a refrigeration company or something.
Okay.
And now he's doing all this charitable works. He said he only bid on the bracelet because all the proceeds are going to charity. Remember, Eastgate donated all to help build schools in Africa or something like that, I think. And that's the only reason that he bid that much on it. And so he felt like he did his good. So now what he wants to do is give it back to the World Series. They can put it in a museum or whatever they want to do with it. And then have a charity tournament where people can buy in for, I don't know, $100 or so, he thinks, and win a replica of it. So, I mean, you're not going to win the actual bracelet. You can't do that. That's kind of weird. But you would win a replica of it.
You know what would be funny is if Peter Eastgate bought it back from him.
And then you keep going back and
keep
forth.
Keep going back and forth. Just keep donating money.
Awesome. I like it.
All right. Now, a little more of the pieces fall into place here. Former world champ Joe Hashem has signed a deal with Asian Logic Group, initially serving as an ambassador for the Asian Poker Tour, according to Poker News. See, now it kind of explains why the whole Poker Stars deal probably didn't happen, because he probably had plans to do something else.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, that I believe we forgot to mention in this whole discussion about why people separate from these poker sites, too, is there's a considerable amount of travel involved in a lot of these deals. I mean, they require you to play a certain amount of events during the year. And so you're constantly on the road. I mean, some people like being on the road, but after a while, it wears on you, no matter who you are, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Except George Clooney. He seems to like it. So, you know, if you decide, you know what, hey, you know, I got a family, I'm just not going to travel as much or not feel like I'm having to travel as much, I'll just, you know, end this deal and obviously give up the perks of it to get my sanity back. And this Asian Poker Tour, it says Asian Poker Tour, but they have events in Australia, too, so we may not have to travel very much with this. So that makes perfect sense.
Sure, and he's on that side of the world, so even to go up to the Asian Tour is like the equivalent of going from Florida to Maine or, you know, or whatever. So, you know, it's not that much of a travel for him either, and he's still close to home and within a few hours rather than 14 hours to Vegas or whatever it is. So
certainly.
Makes sense.
All right, and finally, two New Jersey brothers returning from the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure were detained for not declaring $26,000 on their customs forms. Their attorney called it a, quote, innocent mistake, but the brothers pleaded guilty and forfeited the money, Chris.
Oh, jeez.
NewJersey.com reported this story.
Oh, man. That's brutal.
All right, folks, here's the lesson. Fill out those forms. All right, I speak from experience. I made the same mistake that these poor guys did. I thought I did the same innocent mistake that they did. Thought that it was individual, not as a group. Hey, my wife's with me. She has less than 10,000. I have less than 10,000. I got pinched, and fortunately, I got very nice customs folks that said, Scott, don't worry about it. Report it. You're good. These guys lost $26,000, Chris.
Oh, my God. That is absolutely brutal.
$26,000. Just fill out the form, folks.
Brutal.
Wow.
Well, the thing that about that to me, it just seems like why does the, and what this would actually be, I guess, why does the American government deserve that money because this guy didn't. You know what I mean? That's a huge fine.
Well, I think it was actually a Bahamian court. So I mean, it was a free custom. This is where they're an interesting thing, too, is normally when you clear customs, it's when you get back on U.S. soil, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I was saying.
You go through. Here it was like a pre-customs thing where they went through something, and it ended up being a Bahamian court. So I don't know. Maybe the rules are different. I don't really know. But bottom line, just report it. And particularly, report it. Just report it.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to report it, think about where you are and when you're leaving.
Yeah.
I would think a poker tournament that has thousands of people flying into it, the customs officials might be a little heightened on the $10,000 claiming thing at that point, right?
Absolutely.
I would think, you know what? Hey, you know what? This is what we talk about, the fat, lazy cops that need to get their quota of tickets in. You know, where are you going to go? You're going to go on, the freeway where everybody's going 75, or you're going to go to the residential area where everybody's going 45 when it should be 25?
Right.
Easy pickings there. Got to be easy pickings here, right? Hey, you got 10,000? No, not me. And you get your baseball hat screwed on backwards and big jewelry and stuff and, pocket aces tattooed on your arm. Yeah, I think we're going to do a little profiling here.
Well, somebody always has his hat screwed on correctly and always claims his winnings. O'Malley. Here's our new O'Malley's Move.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're sitting at that same old 1-2 No Limit Hold'em casino cash game. We're at a full table of 10 players. The action's been pretty wild post-flop, but there's been a lot of limping pre-flop, with raises coming from ace-queen or better. We currently sit with 325 and are the big stack at the table, but only by about 25 bucks. The max buy-in here is 300. The blinds post, the under-the-gun limps in, under-the-gun plus 1, 2, and 3 all fold, and the under the gun plus 4 and 5 call. We look down in the cutoff at 8 of hearts, 6 of hearts. Pretty good hand with so much limping going on. We make the call, as does the button, and the small blind, and the big blind checks. An interesting 7-handed pot, which is now $14. We're met with mixed emotions as we see the flop come down, queen of hearts, 9 of hearts, 4 of hearts. This would be an awesome flop if we were 2 or 3 handed. So we set out to make a plan for this hand. If it's checked to us, we're going to bet about pot or more to disguise our hand and thin the field. If someone bets to us, we'll reevaluate. The small blind checks, as does the big blind and the under the gun. But the under-the-gun plus 4 leads out for $9, and the under-the-gun plus 5 more than triples that bet to $30. These two players have been extremely wild all night, and since they just limped preflop, there's no putting them on a hand. They play fearlessly and aggressively, and their chip stacks show that. Constantly going up and down, like a roller coaster. The player directly to my right has roughly 270. After his raise. We're in a tight spot, because the player behind us has about 100 and has been a rock all night. We try to gauge what he's going to do, but he calmly sits, shuffling his chips, patiently waiting for us to make our decision. Normally, we would love to have two maniacs on our right. But in a situation like this, it's hard to tell if our baby flush is good or second best. It's that classic way ahead or way behind scenario. Not to mention the three players that checked to the under the gun plus 4. We have no idea what they're going to do. Although we suspect they'll get out of the way. After the rake, the pot is at $48. And we have to call 30 to see the turn. So we've come to a decision. Call? Fold? Or is there a case for raising?
All right, once again, Chris, we are taking an item that probably was going to be a banter item, and then we started thinking about it, and we're like, wow, we could turn an entire show into this. Or at least we can attempt to.
Hey, you don't survive 8 years every single week without find a little nugget here and there for a show.
Getting creative, swinging for the fences sometimes, right? All right, well, you know, a few weeks ago, one of our listeners alerted us to the latest in a string of news reports that said that Zynga, the maker of the most popular Facebook games, was consistently denying any interest in entering the for-money poker arena. We conveniently kept putting it off, talking about it on the show, and it looks like that was for the best, since now we're getting reports that the company is changing its tune. So on today's show, we're going to dig deeper into what Zynga would mean for regulated poker, as well as what some other companies not yet in the forefront would stand to gain from it, and when and if that ever happens here in the States, which we are hoping will happen very soon.
I tell you, I don't remember who it was, but literally within the last 2 weeks, someone had like come up to me and said, "Hey, what do you think about Zynga? You think they're gonna do real money gambling?" And I was like, "No, they have no interest in doing it." Because they said they have no interest in doing it. And now it's like, Zynga! Or as Sheldon would say, Buzzinga.
Buzzinga.
I can't believe it. And, you know, I think my family has played Zynga poker on there. I obviously don't have a Facebook account, and I won't play that stuff. But my family's played it. And, you know, there were some things on there that I thought were highly questionable at the time. So if this does happen, we'll have to... I'm sure we're going to get into it in the show, but it's just, yeah. It's very interesting to me that now all of a sudden, you know, I mean, I think it's a huge, huge, huge thing if it happens. But at the same time, I don't know how many of those people would actually play for real money either. So let's get into it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure, unless you're one of the four people in the world that haven't heard of Zynga, but in case you are one of the four people that haven't heard of Zynga, you're listening to the show, but we'll tell you a bit more. To me, Zynga is the reason most of us hate Facebook. And I know you're not on Facebook, so you don't know why to hate Facebook, but this is one of the reasons. They're the maker of those popular games like Farmville and Mafia Wars,
right,
which fill our inbox requests from high school classmates with whom we don't even remember going to high school. And they also make the Words with Friends, which is totally awesome, I think. And, of course, they make the largest free poker game in the world. 7 million daily users play poker on Zynga, Chris.
Oh, my God.
7 million. That's almost as many as listen to us on a weekly basis. The games are free to play, but players can buy credits or earn them from Zynga partners to advance in the games. And those deals have made the publicly traded Zynga worth an estimated $9 billion. Again, just slightly less than the market capitalization of Andia Publishing, LLC.
All that money, why do they even care about real poker?
Well,
you know, $9 billion.
And I think that's a good point. I mean, we'll talk about that a little bit into why they might. But yeah, when you've got a good thing going, you want to be sure you don't upset the apple cart getting greedy. You know, if you're getting that golden egg out of the goose, you know, the fable tells you don't cut the goose open. There's not gold in there.
Man.
So, you know, if you're making whatever the revenue is, I mean, their market cap's $9 million. You don't want to mess with that. At the same time, if you can make turn your company into a $90 billion company by becoming for money poker, yeah, you probably should consider it. But let's start with the denials. As late as January 2nd of this year, company officials were still insisting that they have absolutely no interest in entering the for money arena. And the big reason I heard, and I'm interested what you think about this, what they cited was it's playing for money will change the fabric of the social aspect of the game by pitting friends and family members against each other for money. So, in other words, right now, when you're playing Zynga, you're playing poker against your mom or your uncle or your best friend from high school.
Right.
And it's just fun. You're like, you know, hey, all right, I got a full house, I beat you straight. Then, all of a sudden, you interject taking the rent money from that high school friend. Then you can sour relationships. There's no souring of relationships when you're playing for fun, you know, unless you're just a jerk and taunting.
Right.
And that's a big thing. I mean, again, we talk about they built into a $9 billion company based off of this social fun, let's just get together and have fun and bug everybody on Facebook business model. And then all of a sudden, if you introduce for money, obviously we all think that that's a cash cow. But then you just drive everybody away and make everybody angry. There's some risk involved.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. 100%. The only reason why is because what do best friends all around the world do? They get together and play home games for money. We do it. Family members do it all the time with their friends and their family members. They play, but they play for smaller stakes. So if you're going to play for money somewhere, and your friends want to play with you, your family wants to play with you. It's just a friendly thing. I mean, I'm assuming that you're not going to play your Grandma Moses for her rent money on Zynga. But, you know, maybe some people will. I don't know. But I just don't think of it as people are going to fight each other for their... You know, I don't... I play in a very friendly home game at, you know, with you guys. But we still want to take each other's money. And we're not going to be friends the next week. You know, we're still friends. We just play for money against each other.
Right.
So I don't see Zynga as that hurting their reputation or hurting their relationships or being in a family or friendly environment. I don't think it's going to hurt that.
You're probably right, but I mean, I guess the flip side of your argument is that, you know, we got together to play poker because we were already poker players that wanted to play for money. I mean, here you're taking somebody that's playing poker just because it's for fun, and then all of a sudden giving them an option to play for money, and they probably don't realize some of the problems involved with that, or the potential pitfalls, because they think it's going to be the same thing as it is now. And remember, it could be the same thing for you. You could just check raise grandma and take $200 off her and think that you're just having fun, and now grandma's ticked off. Like, screw you, you're not getting a Christmas gift from me this year. It's different just because of the people involved and what they're expecting right now.
Yeah.
But in a larger sense, you're right. It's probably not that big of an issue.
All right, and the key word you used in there was option. They don't have to play for money. If it's going to piss them off, or they know they're going to lose money, or they can lose money, they won't do it.
Well,
and, you know.
You're right. But I go back to when I first started playing online, and I would play, hey, there's no seats of the 1-2 no limit. I'll play the 2-4 no limit. Absolutely insane.
Yeah.
I would never think about playing 2-5 no limit now. But back then, I didn't think any different. There was any difference. Hey, it's no limit. You just bet whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing. I mean, what's the difference? You know, we've been playing right now for credits. Now we're just playing for money. And then all of a sudden you find out, oh. Guess Granny's not going to be able to afford that assisted living facility now.
I think the reason why they've changed their mind is because that's really not a big enough reason to not do it. So I think that's why they're changing their tune.
All right. Well, yeah, we did say they did potentially change their tune. Now, the one story I saw was laden with unnamed sources and stuff. And, you know, as professional journalists, we always are very cautious about who's saying what or not. But the reports were that they're in talks with potential partners to explore what would be involved in running a for our money site. So it's not like they abandoned all that and saying, hey, we're marshaling our troops to be ready to get into this for money business. We're just realizing now that we might have been a little naive in saying we don't need to be in this market. We need to at least explore it and find out whether it's something we should be in.
Yeah, I don't know, because when it got posted on Poker News, it was like, Zynga changing its mind. And it's like, did it change its mind, or is it just wondering? You know what I mean? There's a difference between changing your mind and wondering. So
Right.
Yeah.
Well, from what I read, it's the wondering stage.
Okay.
I mean, other people might have gotten better information from people that are willing to use their name at the company that say, hey, we're definitely changing. But I think it's good enough about the fact that they have been at least open to it now.
Right.
You know, we'd get excited at the government level when they first seemed open to thinking about online poker, you know, even though obviously the whole excitement is waiting to when it's actually regulated. But I think that's the same way. I think we could be excited that they're open now, and it's just up to other people to convince them that this is something they should do.
Well, let me ask you, are we excited about it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we got some advantages and disadvantages on the nose here, so we can get through those, and then we can probably talk about how excited we are. I mean, one of the advantages, obviously, is that instant player liquidity. I mean, this is what we're talking about right now in these state-by-state things is, one, you're going to have to build up a base of players, which takes a while. And then you've got a ceiling on how many players can play. You know, what online poker site would not want to have 7 million daily users already registered and playing on their product, and then just have to convert them into for money?
Yeah.
That's so much easier than going out and building up 7 million daily users outside the world. So,
yeah.
And then think about people playing. They know 7 million, and not all of them are going to be playing for money. A good chunk of them will. You know, when you go out and play on a Zynga for money site, that there's going to be a game going on.
Yep.
That's huge.
It is huge. And the other thing, though, is, and I don't think we're going to get into it here, and you and I didn't really research this, but I remember back, even in the heyday of online poker, when you would sign on to one of the sites and it would say something like 40,000 people are playing poker right now. But then I remember reading something somewhere where it was like only like 2% of that is playing for real money. And the other 35,000, 36,000 are playing for play money. So I wonder what the percentages are. And I'm not saying those are the correct percentages. I just remember reading an article where it was really drastic, where you thought, oh my God, there's a million people on this site, but only 20,000 of them are playing for money. So I wonder what the breakdown will end up being. How many will actually be players playing for money on the site? You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, even 1%, that's 7 million.
Yeah.
It's quite a lot of people.
It's incredible.
More than are playing in your local casino, I guarantee you that.
Yeah.
Also, obviously, they have the name recognition. I mean, as we said at the top of the show, everybody has heard of Zynga, or at least one of their games. So, you know, when you're looking, particularly in this, and I think this is going to be key when we get this regulated market now, we've been so rocked with these companies that have gone askew, you know, the super user, UB, the full tilt not paying out. I think people are going to be cautious, not everybody, but a lot of people are going to be cautious getting into this arena, and they're going to want to go with a name that they know and trust over anything else. I mean, even if you get a better sign-on deal from somebody, you know, Daniel's matey from Christmas site, is giving you $1,000 extra for Bobo750 code, I'm still going to play with Zynga because I just know him and trust him, and I don't want to take the shot, right?
Right. So. Before I want to, 1% of 7 million is 70,000 players.
Yeah.
So that's still more than when you were playing on the height of PokerStars or whatever. Usually it was about 35 or 40,000 that you'd see that were playing online or whatever, but 1% of 7 million is 70,000, so
yeah,
it's still a huge, huge field.
And then, of course, their software. I mean, obviously, they have a software platform up. People are playing on it now. Obviously, I haven't played on it, and I know you've talked to some friends that it probably needs some help, but I mean, at that point, you've got the software, the playing software built. You just have to add in the payment processing and probably some more security features. But that's a huge leg up on competitors that either need to partner with somebody to bring the software in or need to write it from scratch.
Absolutely. I do think that they would need to write something from scratch, but they wouldn't do that until they're ready to launch, so it makes no difference. So you're still playing for free, playing for free, playing for free, and then all of a sudden, boom, they're like, hey, if you want to play for money, here's the new platform and, you know, whatever. So They got a huge leg up on us. So other sites. I wondered if all of these other sites and potential sites are absolutely scared crapless by this. Because
I think they should be. They absolutely are. I mean, you know, when I wrote the disadvantages here, they're pretty weak. I mean, real quickly, we mentioned the software's advantage. It's also a disadvantage. I mean, you know, players that have been playing on PokerStars are accustomed to a real strong software that lots of features. And, you know, how many times did you, before Black Friday, did you go out and people say, oh, I don't play on that site because I hated the software?
Right.
But poker players are real picky about the software, and it needs to be quick, it needs to render right. You know, so if this software isn't doing that now, the demands are different from a for money crowd than a playing with your grandma crowd, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they're going to want notes. They're going to want, you know, rake back or whatever. You know, they're going to want all of that stuff. So they're going to have to really revamp the actual software. I don't think the existing software is not going to cut it. I can even recall the family members telling me that they were playing in pots where they would go all in. Somebody who had less money than would go all in. The person with less money would call, and they would get all the money. I'm like, wait a minute, they had less
money
than you.
Were they playing against Russ Hamilton?
So, exactly. So, I mean, I don't know if that's been fixed since then, but a lot of people were saying that that's happened. And, I mean, it opens up if you know, there are a lot of iPad apps that have online poker in them or iPhone apps or whatever where you can play against other people on that platform. And, you know, all of a sudden now these guys, all they got to do is apply for a license or whatever and then those people are in it. So it opens up a lot of software issues to me that they better be regulated. So I think that they're going to have to go through the regulation pretty strictly, because the software they have now just won't hold up.
Yeah, and the other thing, obviously, is again, another advantage is a reputation. It's also a disadvantage. You know, if I'm a hardcore, real-money poker player, which I don't know if I'm hardcore, but I don't play free poker.
Right.
Am I going to respect a brand like Zynga that has been entirely free up until now?
I understand.
Am I going to want to go play on that versus playing on a Caesars Entertainment site or a site run by a company that's been in gaming and understands the real money platform?
Absolutely. You know, and it's the problem with, you know, when you're playing for play money with somebody and they don't care and they're just shoving all the time, and you have to adjust to that, but it diminishes your actual skills for real money because they don't care, and that's a real good point. Of course, that also opens up to it being like the heyday where you and I were paying off loans and stuff with the money we were winning on different sites because people were so bad. You know, I mean, so it's
well, yeah,
good and bad.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I mean, your question to me a little bit ago was, you know, are we excited about Zynga? And I think one of the reasons not to be excited is that it is going to have the biggest splash right away, I would think, of any company. I think a lot of sharp players are going to try it out because they think it's easy pickings. And I think, as we've all learned at some point in our poker career, you don't want to play against people that have no idea what they're doing.
Right.
You want to play against people that know just enough to be dangerous. You know, if I'm playing against, I go down the street and ask a random person, have you ever played poker? No. And I'm going to play against them, I have no idea what they're doing. They might think Queen 2 is a great hand.
Yeah.
Whereas if I give them a 2-hour lesson, then I'm going to have a better shot at getting their money because they have a basic idea what they should or shouldn't do. They're just not as experienced as I am.
It's a great
point. So when you get into Zynga, I think people are going to think that this is a golden goose, and no doubt a lot of people are going to make a lot of money off the Zynga players. But there's also going to be a lot of people that are too confident for their own good and find out that playing against people that have no idea what they're doing isn't worth the frustration.
What about the fact that Zynga and Facebook have been around for a long time, and most of these 7 million people have learned how to play now, and now they're just enough to know dangerous?
But have they?
I don't know.
I mean,
you can't play on that site for 3 years playing for playing money, not realize what a straight is or what a good starting hand is by then.
You're right, but it's certainly it's made players better. There's leaderboards and all kinds of stuff, so there's something to play for. It's just not as important to us as it is to those people. So,
I remember,
it's developed some tough players.
And yeah, it has to have, because I remember, weren't they even extending an offer that Nations Cup or something to the Zynga community because they had so many players and so many decent players that they were like trying to put a team together to play in that again? I remember reading a story about that too. So, I mean, obviously there's some people on there who have been playing pretty seriously and logging a lot of hours enough that they think they're good enough to form a team, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I think there's going to be a good mix of players on this site. Especially, you know, 70,000 players, they're not going to be all, you know, completely ignorant. It's going to be a good mix, and I think there's going to be a lot of easy pickings for money on this if that ends up happening.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess the downside why we may not want Zynga is if it sucks the entire player base into Zynga, then it becomes the whole... obviously not going to be a monopoly. We're going to have, you know, the Caesars of the world, we're going to have the party pokers, those that are going to be in there and have significant market share. But if the player liquidity is so much more on a site that we've determined that we don't want to play on, that's not good.
Yeah.
You know, think about it. If you didn't like PokerStars back before Black Friday, it was tough because, I mean, you could play on other sites that, you know, there's no reason you shouldn't play on them, but... You know, you start looking at the tournament payouts and the prize pools on PokerStars, and if you don't like that playing on that site, you're not going to be able to win those.
Right.
You're not going to be able to convince those players to leave that and come play on your other site. It's much harder. And this is a danger not just with Zynga, but with any of the online sites that populate here. You know, if one of them gets too big too fast and you happen just not to like it, it's going to be frustrating.
Right, I mean, they broke up Ma Bell for a reason. You know what I mean? You don't want somebody to have, you know, antitrust. You know, that's so obviously it's going to be competitors and market share. You don't want them to be too dominant because you want everyone to have their chance at that pie. But you're right; it is going to be overwhelming how many fish or players that don't know what they're doing are going to be on that site versus other sites.
All right, well, that was a good discussion, and I just want to mention at the end, too, I mean, talking about Zynga, you start to realize, and it was a great story that one of our listeners sent us from the Business Insider, that actually made me think about who's really stands to gain from this. And remember, the Zynga stuff isn't specific to Facebook. They have Android and standalone apps and stuff, too, but certainly they've grown leaps and bounds from their relationship with Facebook. And it's the world's largest social networking site. Really stands to gain a lot of money if they're comfortable with Zynga being in the real money, because they get 30% right now of all the Facebook credits bought for Zynga games.
Wow.
Now, I don't know how that relationship changes when you're talking about buy-ins for real money games. I'm sure there's renegotiation going on, but whatever it is, it's going to be substantial. So there's one industry insider's predicting that it can increase Facebook's revenue by 25 times. A staggering $100 billion a year. It's $100 billion a year in revenue, making the company worth, you know, a gajillion more than that.
Man, that's crazy. And I could have sworn
and
I'd seen
a story.
Anything.
I mean, yeah. just being the one to see this site in its infancy and partnering with it.
And it's not just that. They also benefit from every person like me who's not on Facebook thinking, well, if I'm going to play legitimate poker against people who aren't very good or a big prize pool or a big player pool, I'm going to want to have to play on Zynga, and if I can't play on it other than being on Facebook, then I'm going to have to join Facebook. So they'll also get more people on there. Not that they need it. They got billions or whatever, but right. I'm not on there. I know a lot of people who aren't on Facebook, believe it or not. So they would ultimately end up getting me somehow. I'd create some sort of account if that was the only place I could play online, or if it was so juicy that I had to get on there. So they would gain people that way and then ultimately gain more money from that as well, not just poker, but being on Facebook and their ads and their whatever, so branding. So it's a huge, huge game turner. I could have sworn I thought I read something about Facebook saying they weren't interested in the for money aspect of gambling on their site, but you know, I didn't have time to really research it carefully.
Well, very well. Again, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if they also were throwing out those denials too, because again, I mean, they've got an amazing business as it is. So
yeah,
I mean, why?
Yeah.
Why upset the apple cart? But think about this, too, in terms of a Zynga Facebook site. I mean, I think a number of these subscription sites and free play sites are trying to do now, trying to turn it into a social environment where it's more social than the real money sites where you had a chat box where you just sent nasty things that you wouldn't say to a person in real life.
Right.
But the whole social networking part of this, I think, is important in terms of getting people to play more often. I mean, think about how excited we were when PokerStars announced its home games application. And imagine where that would be now if it wasn't for Black Friday. I mean, people are still playing it. Americans are still playing on it, even though they can't play for real money. I mean, that's where our Pape series is. But if you have that social networking thing where you decide. I mean, one of the big things that a lot of people say they don't want to play online poker for is they don't know who they're playing against.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, if you log in and you know you're playing with people that you're Facebook friends, you know who you're playing with for the most part. I mean, obviously somebody could be still playing for them, but if you're conversing with them, I think you're going to figure out pretty quickly whether it's their 7-year-old son playing for them or whether it's actually them. That's powerful in driving traffic. You know, if I'm at home at night and I'm like, hey, I want to play, do I want to play poker or not? Eh, I don't want to play with a bunch of strangers. But somebody sends you an IM and says, hey, we're playing poker tonight on Facebook, Zynga. You know, that's tough to say no to at that point.
And it also,
that's powerful.
It also brings up the whole, even more so now, the necessity for things being regulated and security measures put in place for children. Like you just said, you know, if the 7-year-old's playing for them on your account. Well,
yeah.
You know, every teenager on the planet has a Facebook account, you know what I mean? So they're going to have to really revamp the security measures too on this. So it's going to take some time. It's not going to happen overnight. Obviously, we still have to get it regulated here, but they could do it in other countries. I remember there was something about in the United Kingdom that they were trying to get their ducks in a row to have gambling there, so on Facebook or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but it's going to be a real game changer if it happens.
Absolutely.
This is Daniel Negreanu of FullContactPoker.com. You're listening to Ante Up.
All right, the funny thing, Chris, about us relaxing our swag policy, and again, remind folks that you know, you can win a piece of swag. After 1 year, you're back in the hopper, right?
Yep.
And since we've announced that, I think we've had one repeat person win a piece of swag. And we've gotten all kinds of submissions from first-timers this time, and our handle of the week is from yet another one, Richard Bodanar. B-O-D-A-N-R. He's missing a vowel there. I wonder if Daniel Negreanu is his friend. Should be like an E or something there, right?
I don't know.
All right. He was playing a home game tournament, all right?
Okay.
$200 buy-in.
Wow.
This must be a doctor or a lawyer or something.
He's wow.
Certainly not a magazine publisher. $200 buy-in for the home game. They get 20,000 chips, no rebuys. No re-entries, no conceding your chip stack.
Can't come back the next day when I'm trying to have dinner with my family.
Yep. One and done here. 13 people to start.
Okay.
So the villain in this story is a solid player who's very methodical, calculates the pot odds for all hands. I wonder if his name is Rant or Gundam. he says he's only seen to show a rare semi-bluff. Only played about 30% of his hands, and when playing to the end, always showed a strong hand.
I like that he says only about 30%. That's a lot of hands. That's more than the average.
That's more than I play, absolutely. Yeah. All right, four players left in the tournament. The small stack of 25K is to our heroes left. The chip leader's across the table from third big stack is to his right. He goes on to cripple the big stack with pocket ace to his ace king. Big stack is left with 30K, and I'm now the big stack. Our hero is, right? Player to my right is now second in chips. We played for a while, and the second chips takes it to third and fourth players. So we're just giving you the narrative of the tournament here.
Okay, so we're knowing all this for no reason, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's fun, you know, when you're retelling the story to your friends.
Right, right.
All right, so we're heads up now, right?
All right.
Blinds are 5K, 10K. And our hero has about 170K, and the villain has 90K in chips. All right.
So
we got him almost 2-1.
Right.
Pass the blinds back and forth for about 10 minutes. Here comes the fun, he says. I'm the big blind with king of diamonds, eight of diamonds. I check, the villain calls, or...
I assume he means he calls and the villain checks.
Villain calls, I check, yeah.
All right.
The flop comes, queen of diamonds, eight of clubs, six of diamonds. Our hero bets 50K with his middle pair and flush draw. The villain goes all in.
Hmm. Oh, man. Well, I'd like to say first that it's just my way of playing, but if I'm heads up with somebody and I have a hand as good as King 8 suited, I'm raising. Just want to say that out loud first.
Yeah.
I'm not saying what he did was wrong, because how do I know that he didn't raise five times before that with King 8? Now he's
right.
Changing his game. So. There's nothing wrong with it, but I normally would have raised with King 8 playing heads up with the chip lead, and it looks as though when you say we pass the blinds back and forth about 10 minutes, it sounds like they're not getting too aggressive or they're waiting for a hand to get it in. So to me, I would just keep raising with my no matter what my two cards are until this guy puts up a stand, and then I'd reassess. So first of all, I would have raised with King 8, but since we haven't raised, and I have no idea the outcome of this hand, so I'm not results-oriented. And I don't know if he wins or loses, so I'm not thinking that way. I'm just saying that I would have raised, and when that flop comes, and I bet 50 and he shoves, I'm calling. 50, to me, since it didn't raise pre-flop, there was 20 in the pot. 50's probably a big bet there, because you've bet almost, you bet, what, 2.5 times the size of the pot?
Yeah, 2.5 times the pot.
That's a lot of money to bet when you're playing heads up, and, I mean, I would bet maybe... You know, it's just maybe 10, maybe 15 there. 15.
Yeah.
You know, so 50 is a lot. I never would have bet that. So I'm not betting 50. I'm betting 15. If at that point he had shoved, I probably still would have called because I've got a pair. I've got what seems to be a bazillion outs. If you think mm-hmm. about the flush draw, a king, another eight, they're probably all outs for me.
Right.
So I can't fold. I have a chip lead, and if I lose it, I'm still in the game, so and significantly in the game. So I think that, one, I would have raised preflop. Two, since I didn't raise preflop, I wouldn't have bet that much. I would have bet about a third of what he bet there, and then taken it from there. But since we didn't and he shoved, given the predicament that he's in, I have to call here. I'm not folding here.
Right.
Now, if you want to do the math on it, there's 70 in the middle plus this guy's remaining stack before he shoved. So he had 90. So you're looking at, because again, I don't know how much he had after all the blinds went back and forth and everything, but roughly if he had 90, and so it'd be probably what? It was 10, so that'd be 80. So we put in, so he's only got to call, what, 30 more? Right? 30, 80, so 90, yeah. So, I mean, really, it's like 30,000 more he has to call to win 110 or whatever. So he's getting way in 3-1 his money. I'm definitely, I mean, I wouldn't have thought about all that anyway. I just would have looked at his stack, looked at my stack, and said, yeah, that's about right, and called. So
yeah.
I'm calling.
All right, so that's what we do. And our villain shows Queen of Clubs, Six of Hearts. Next two cards are blanks, and now our heroes are short stack. So we have two hands of the week here out of this.
Well, at that one, I mean, again, you have to think that you can't just put him on Queen 6 there or Queen 8 or 8-6.
Of course not. Absolutely.
There's just no way. He might have a queen in his hand. He might have a draw himself. And if it was the nut draw, you think he would have raised pre-flop. So you would think that your diamond draw would be better anyway. There's just no way I'm getting away from this, and there's no way I put him on Queen 6. And I think given his broad range at a heads-up hand, you've made the right play in calling. There's nothing wrong there. I don't like the bet.
Yeah, you have outs to anything he has.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point. You are the chip leader, and you have a pair and a flush draw. I mean, doesn't get too much better than that heads-up. I mean, if you're waiting to flop sets heads up, you're going to be
broke.
Blood dry.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, well, the next hand, our hero's a small blind, the villain's a big, still at the 5,000, 10,000 level. Our hero has Jack of Clubs, Seven of Diamonds, and just calls.
All right, so we're on the button again?
He calls,
so we're on the button. Again, when I play heads up, I like to, if I'm going to limp, a lot of times I want to limp with a hand that's bigger than that, because I want to be I don't want him to give an idea that I have a big hand. But generally, I'm just raising anyway with any two cards when I'm on the button, especially when this person showed, you know, that he's willing to give up his big blind. So I don't like limping, and Jack 7 is not a great hand. It's not even better than average. So I think that would raise or fold. I don't like limping and hoping to hit, because then you're just requiring yourself to hit or get in trouble.
I never limp playing heads up.
Yeah, I almost never.
I just don't get it. The great thing about playing heads up, and I really enjoy playing heads up, and I've had some success at it, and I don't really know exactly why. But part of it, one of the things you need to do is just be consistent, because you have such a smaller degree of information heads up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you got a bunch of different people raising and falling, and then you can start narrowing different hands and figure out what people have. Heads up, it's really a game of chicken. And so I want to be consistent. So if I'm going to raise, I'm going to always raise the same amount pre-flop, and I'm always going to fold. And I may do it with different hands, but limping, I don't think helps anything, really.
No, I mean, if
consistently. So if you start limping, then people are going to start watching what hands you're limping with, and they're going to start putting you on ranges when you raise, when you fold, and when you limp.
And if you're always a raiser and then you limp, then it's really fishy. So,
absolutely.
I mean, you want to be consistent no matter what you do. The other thing, too, that I don't... One of the problems I have with heads-up play sometimes in tournament situations, not cash games, but in tournament situations, are we still using the whole 8 big blinds rule to determine whether or not we're shoving or not? Or because you're so your heads up, and the odds of you getting blinds back and forth so many times are greater, that, you know, are you still going with the 8x rule, or are you reducing that to now like 4x because it's only one other opponent and you're playing every hand anyway?
I think it's completely different myself. I think I mean these heads up games can turn on a dime,
right?
And we just saw this with the last hand. I mean, we were a 2-1, almost 2-1 chip leader, and then got it all in, and now we're the short stack, right?
Right.
So with a hand like Jack of Clubs and Seven of Diamonds, I'm going to fold that generally. I just don't want to commit my stack on that. Again, I mean, it's a game of chicken. But I would rather have a hand that I've got some shot at connecting, so I'm not just bluffing all the time on the flop. And I'm going to make it really hard for my opponent to get my remaining chips.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the conventional wisdom is, hey, I'm short, I need to be aggressive and get it in and just hope for the best. And I play the exact opposite there. I'm going to make it really, really, really work to get my chips. And I'm not going to keep folding until I get down all the way to, like, one big blind. But I'd be willing to fold that on this hand and probably the next couple before I start getting a little less selective.
Okay, so you're saying, like, if you got to, like, 50 grand, then you think you'd be in shove or fold mode?
Well, yeah. I mean, at that point, I can't be picky. Okay. Right now, I still feel like I can be picky and not have to raise out of position with jack 7. Which is not a bad hand, heads up. I mean, you got a jack. I mean, he could have all kinds of different things, but I'm not excited about hitting my 7 now.
Right. I think the worst thing to do is to limp, though, with the stack that
absolutely,
he has.
Yeah.
It's either a raise or a fold here.
If you raise, and then you're putting pressure on him, and he might decide, you know what, hey, I just got the chip lead again. I'm not willing to give it right back to you, so I'm going to fold, and I'll let you. I play the same way if I'm the chip leader, too. I mean, if you want to keep raising, I'll keep giving my big blind until I get something where I can play back at you for a while. Until I mean, I set a level in my head where I know, all right, it's been enough. Now I need to get more creative. So
I guess the other problem, though, is let's say it's something a little better than Jack 7, like Jack 10, and you're going to raise with this hand. What do you raise to? I mean, are you going to bet 40% of your stack with a raise? Because then why aren't you just shoving then?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we got, 50K or a little less than 50K.
We have 80,000, right? What do we have, 80?
Let's see. Well, yeah, 85 before the call, so.
Okay, so let's say we had 75, right? If you were going to raise 3X, that's 30,000. That's like almost 50% of your stack. It's like 40%. Yeah. So if you're going to bet 40% of your stack, why not shove and put them to a test? So it's either a fold or shove almost, it seems like.
And, you know, and that almost gets into what I'm saying then. If you're right, you're not going to raise 30K, so you're going to shove. Now, 80K, that seems like a big bet then, right?
Yeah.
So that to me, that tells me I've got some play here.
Yeah.
I don't have to be desperate. I don't have to go all in with this because I've got Jack 7. I can fold here, and then I'll get the 10K on the next one. And, you know, once I get down to 40, about 40K or so is when I know I need to play.
Yeah, because that's what a base.
And hopefully I'll get better hands in between. I don't have to worry about it. But
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I understand.
I mean, it's this weird thing here where you're right. Do we really want to bet 80K with Jack 7 offsuit?
Right.
And at the same time, if we raise with anything else, we're not going to fold.
Right.
On the flop. It's going to get in anyhow. So you've got this weird situation where you're almost forced to be a little bit or giving a green light to be a little bit more selective, even though you're short stack.
Yeah, I it's weird. I would probably fold that hand and move on, or I would shove with it. And I don't want to shove with Jack 7, so I think you're right. I think I would just fold that hand. Yeah. Well, what happens? Because we just called, right? You said?
All right. Yeah, we just made call. We just made the call. Villain checks 2. Flop comes 7 of clubs, deuce of diamonds, 4 of hearts. And as I'm sure everybody would do, we go all in for our remaining 80K.
Yeah. I don't know, now that we've limped and we're in the pot with 75,000 left, there's only 20 in the pot, I don't know if I would shove there either. I think I would try to get maximum value out of it.
Yeah, you're right, I'm sure. I shouldn't have said that. But yeah, we're definitely betting, I guess, is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, no, but I think I'm still betting 15,000, trying to get as much out of the guy as I can. And then if he's real aggressive, maybe I even, because he checks to us, so... You know, I don't know. Maybe I even give him a street, but to bluff at it. But I think I'm betting because it looks suspicious if I don't bet, and then all of a sudden wake up on the turn and bet. Maybe I just bet now because either he's going to have a hand or he's not to call me with. So I think I'm betting like 15 there. I'm not shoving because why shove?
Yeah,
I'm just trying to scare him. It looks like.
Yeah. No. I mean, you're completely right. But if we do take it down here, that's another 20K that we add to our stack, 100K,
yeah.
And knocks him down to.
You're
60. So I mean, there is value in winning that and not hanging yourself. But interesting.
I think I would have bet, and then who knows what would have happened. But we went all in.
We go all in, and I'll go ahead and finish it because it doesn't really matter, and we could talk more about more heads up here. The villain does call. He flips over deuce of clubs, four of spades. two blanks and our hero takes second place. So he wrote in, this is really kind of a situation that we kind of turned into two hands a week, but you want to know if you can play these hands differently, and if so, how. I could raise both times before the flop to try to steal the blind, but was doing that with any ace, two high cards, or suited connectors above seven. So the raise was usually 2 to 3x. Sometimes it caused a fold, and other times it did not. Could not tell on flops that I missed whether he had me beat or went or not when he raised.
Well, here's something. Well, first of all, I think we addressed the hand, the first hand, enough that we don't have to really revisit it. But when he says that he had been raising with any ace, two high cards, or suited connectors, then he, and then when he doesn't raise, then what's he telling his opponent? Yeah. That he doesn't have those hands. And the two hands that he sends in, he doesn't raise with pre-flop when he should have. King 8, you know, isn't in those three hands. So now he's telling the guy that I don't have an ace, I don't have two high cards, and I don't have suited connectors. That's what he's telling the guy. So if he tells the guy that, then I would come over the top and shove on the guy because I know he doesn't have those hands that are calling hands. So he's going to fold to my re-raise. So, or my raise itself because he's just calling. And the same with the last hand, Jack 7. If you've shown down a few hands and every time you've done it was ace high or two high cards or suited connectors, then he's going to think you have ace high, two high cards or suited connectors if you raise with Jack 7 and he folds the deuce 4. So not that we're results oriented, but if you played this hand properly, you're probably not facing the deuce 4 now and you're still alive and who knows what happens after that. In this case, you limped with Jack 7 instead of folding it or raising with it and, mm-hmm. and you came out in second place. So I think there were a lot of different ways you could have played it, but initially it all starts with raising when you're on the button, heads up. Or folding.
Yep.
So.
But yeah, again, I'm just trying not to give my opponents any information. So if I raise, I'm raising the same amount, and I'm going to do it with any card combination. I'm not going to reserve it to cards that I like.
Right.
You know, I'm going to mix it up a little bit. So, and I hope I show down some of that stuff too, so they know I'm capable of raising with anything and capable of betting on the flop with anything. And then that further confuses them because then I'm not, it's not giving them any information. You know, if I raise, it doesn't mean that I have a big hand. It just means that I'm raising. And you've got to figure out whether I have a hand there or not.
Yeah.
And if I fold, you know, that's fine. You don't know what I'm folding. So, but if I'm showing deuce four eventually, then you got to wonder, what am I folding?
And then to get back to his point about how else he could have played differently, I think, again, you know, I wouldn't have bet so much after the flop on both hands. I would not have bet 50K onto the flop on that first hand, and I would not have bet 80K all in, 70 or 80 or whatever it was, after this top pair flop on the last hand. So I think that your betting amounts need to try to extract rather than force out.
Yeah, back when we played a lot of heads up at in these tournaments, Tampa Dan's, I remember playing against a really good opponent, and he kept getting so frustrated at me. He's like, God, it's just impossible to get chips off you. And I felt like I was Iceman from Top Gun. Because I was. I was like, I was just folding all the time when he had good hands. When I was betting, I was betting a little bit, and he was frustrated, and he couldn't. His thing was to shove all the time, and I'm like, fine, you can shove. If I don't have it, I'm not going to give it to you. But the first time you shove with nothing and I have it, guess what? You're in trouble.
Yeah.
So I really think patience and is great in this, not only because it helps you with a lot of other things, but it really frustrates your opponents. When you're playing heads up, I think people play faster heads up, and I think they should be playing slower.
Yeah,
you know, get a little bit of money in, a little bit of money in, and then eventually you're going to frustrate a guy, and he's going to raise you, and you're going to have a set there, and boom, game's over.
Yeah, it's
make
because
you make the mistake.
You know, it's just because so many hands. You know, you get so many hands in an hour or whatever that you're in that mode of playing quick, and then you play your hands fast too, and it's definitely an art to playing heads up. It's not easy, and it's so much fun when you come across somebody who doesn't play heads up. You know, or doesn't have that experience. I mean, when I played online, I would say 70% of all my cash game play was heads up. I used to always go into the heads up tables and play because I loved it. I love that feeling, and I'm not saying I was good at it because I wasn't great at it. I mean, maybe I was a little ahead overall for my career, but I just love that. I love playing every hand, and it's like chess to me rather than poker. So, yeah, when you're playing heads up, you got to make them guess. And because you're in every hand, and so Jack 7, I would have raised or folded. I wouldn't have limped. So I love heads up play. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it's tough to play now without
online. Yeah, you're right.
All right, Richard, we appreciate you sending the hand of the week. Everybody else, send your hand of the week or questions or call the floors or mailbags or comments on our poorly analyzed hand of the week. The podcast at AnnieUpMagazine.com, and you too may win some swag like Richard will. He's going to win a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for the Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app, though. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store.
I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.